Welcome, everyone. I'm going to have our marshal call court to order, please.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Smith, and Judge Flory, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
And welcome again to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today we're doing a Zoom calendar comprised of our oral arguments. And as stated, Mr. Hodge, you were here before, and welcome Mr. Mishick. I want to remind you that the rules of appellate court procedure do remain in place despite our Zoom platform. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your case in chief, with 5 minutes being reserved for rebuttal to appellant counsel if you utilize that. I also want to remind you to indicate your name and which party you're speaking on behalf of for our recording purposes. And we have a clock in my upper left-hand corner, presumably also yours. Keep an eye on that so that you don't necessarily run over time. I'm going to go back to our marshal and have him call the next case that appears on the calendar.
Calling case number A220313, State of Minnesota versus Renard Liddell Carter.
Mr. Mishick, when you're ready to proceed, go ahead.
Thank you, and may it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Chris Mishick, and I represent appellant Renard Carter. Mr. Carter here is convicted of two second-degree murder counts and one count of murder of an unborn child. He's requesting now that this court allow him to withdraw his guilty plea, really for two reasons, two main reasons. The first is that the district court here abused its discretion and erred in denying his sentencing plea withdrawal motion because he presented fair and just reasons, mainly that there was coercion at the time of the plea and that he lacked full awareness of the circumstances at the time of the plea. The second main reason is that he's saying that our argument is that there was an incorrect criminal history score on counts 2 and 3. And because of that, there was a mutual mistake in what the parties understood at the time the plea deal was entered. I think on this second point, you know, Mr. Carter and his attorney really engaged in negotiations and agreed to probably one of the most serious sentences you could agree to under, you know, a life in prison, you know, besides a life imprisonment. However, he didn't enter into this negotiation with his eyes wide open because he didn't understand that on counts 2 and 3, he should have had 0 criminal history points and not 1. I want to go back to this first reason and start there about the fair and just standard. I think that the court here did abuse its discretion in denying the plea withdrawal because, first of all, the fair and just standard is low. It's lower than the manifest injustice standard. And the court, if you look at the court's order, I think it erred in its legal analysis in the sense that it applied the manifest injustice standard in looking at the plea intelligence and the voluntariness of the plea, and essentially said if you can't show that this is a constitutional violation, that the plea is constitutionally invalid, then you don't meet the fair and just standard. And I think that's the wrong analysis here. The fair and just standard is lower, and the court in its analysis held Mr. Carter to a too high a standard. And second, I think on the facts, the court abuses discretion because there was evidence in the record that the plea here was coerced. The court found that really there was no substantiated reasons, but really, if you look at the record, the crux of the matter is the actual plea. The actual plea colloquy. And
well, the way the plea shakes out, but you know, Mr. Mishick, you've been around the block a few times. It's hard to get somebody to, you know, you take a horse to water, but you can't necessarily get him to drink. And I read the transcript and I read what's happened as far as the trial court. And as he was getting closer to trial, it seemed as if there was consistently an effort to get him to plead. What is your strongest argument that you feel that he was coerced? I just don't see anything other than there being plenty of time taken to go off the record, to make sure he knew what he was doing, and to make sure that he was well aware of what was happening. It wasn't like, boom, 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 hurry up, it's time for lunch, we got to go. What is your strongest point?
Well, I think my strongest point is the transcript of the plea colloquy, and that he took three attempts to actually admit to the offense. The first attempt, he's denying completely that he caused the death of the young child. Then he comes back and they start some leading questions, and he agrees, but then they say, well, isn't it true what you said before was false? And he says, no, it was actually true what I said before. And then, so that's a second failure. And then at that point, I think at that point, what should have been done is the plea process should have stopped and they should have set it for trial. But at that point, the judge sort of interjected and said, and got involved and pressured Mr. Carter and said, you can't have it one way or another. One thing's true or not. And I think it was clear on the record that he was uncomfortable going forward with the plea on the second attempt.
As are many defendants under these particular situation. I think in this particular case that when the plea colloquy resumed, that he clearly indicated what he had done and what his involvement was. And I don't know how you can sidestep away from that. I mean, this to me appears more typical than not.
Well, I'm not sidestepping away from the fact that ultimately in the end, yes, he admitted, he said the magic words and said what he did constitute the offense. We don't have a plea accuracy issue here, but I think if you just look at the whole process and how it played out on the record, I think it does show that there was coercion from the court and his attorneys to get where he ended up. And I think the other thing that's not analyzed by the district court is his history of in the Rule 20, where it talks about, his family saying he has a history of intellectual impairment. He was on individual education plans at school. The family, it's told the Rule 20 evaluator that they had concerns about his cognitive impairment. And I think that mixed in with the circumstances gets to coercion. I want to, if you don't have any other questions about the coercion aspect, I want to talk about the intelligence aspect as well. Again, the court essentially held Mr. Carter to too high of a standard. It's the court said, well, because you there was a Rule 20 here that found you competent. You haven't shown that the plea was intelligent. Well, those are two different standards. Competency is a much higher standard, to show incompetency. That's a much higher standard, and I think the court erred in its legal analysis there, and it didn't really flush out again what I just said about his cognitive impairment that the family brought up to the Rule 20 assessor, the fact that he was on individual education programs at school, all these reports of him going to alternative schools. And the Rule 20 report essentially said, I've asked for records, I haven't gotten it back. And then the PSI comes back after that and it unearthed a whole bunch of material showing that, he was diagnosed with mental retardation. He had a significant below average intellect, a low IQ, and then he was found incompetent in a number of cases in the early 2000s. And so I think that the court really didn't flush out. It didn't sufficiently give weight to the things that went towards him not knowing what was fully going on here. And
do we need to understand what is it that he in the fair and just challenge on the basis of intelligence? What did he not understand about the plea? Is that something that you need to explain to us what he didn't understand, or is it just enough to show that he had cognitive challenges?
I think under the fair and just standard, because it's lower, I don't think we necessarily have to show, it arose to a constitutional violation. So, but I think there are issues with what he understood. The plea itself there was a bit of an illusory promise here about him potentially getting out of prison when he was 90. And I don't
know. Now you're talking about the sentence and the presumptive sentence. Hold that for a moment. You know, my concern is a trial court, a district court judge is hearing his complaints or is understanding his complaint that he felt that he was being coerced and that he didn't have time with his attorneys. But isn't that a credibility call? Because the judge also talked with, heard from the attorneys who said, look, you know, we met with him, we told him his options, they explained the little discussion about, I think I can get him there. And I don't remember which attorney said that, but the circumstances, isn't that a credibility call by the judge as to which party is representing the facts as they truly are?
I agree that the court is making, you know, at least implicitly a credibility call in siding with the attorney's version of what happened. I agree with that. But I still think the fact that Mr. Carter told his attorneys, I want to plead guilty to this, I don't think it necessarily negates sort of what happened on the record. And in what I said earlier in this, you know, it's almost pulling teeth to get him to plead guilty and it happening on the third attempt. I think none of that was really analyzed by the court. So that's where I think the district court order got it wrong here. And despite the fact that they would credit the attorneys and their testimony.
Mr. Mishnick, on this intelligence issue, I think, you know, the burden is on Mr. Carter to show a fair and just reason. Other than statements made to the Rule 20 evaluator or in the PSI, did Mr. Carter, through his counsel at the plea withdrawal hearing, present any expert testimony regarding any of those issues?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't expert testimony regarding those issues. And again, I think that's because of the lower fair and just standard. And you know, what I think his attorney's point at the hearing was that he has a history of you know, cognitive impairment, as a Rule 20 report noted. He has PTSD, he has history of depression, and that sometimes, as you know, attorneys, we do seem intimidating in the court, and that Mr. Carter was swept along and swept up in it. So I think that was more of the argument below. But I agree there wasn't expert testimony going towards, calling a psychologist or psychiatrist at a hearing. That didn't happen.
So then that really left the court, going back to Judge Werke's question. Then the court had to make credibility determinations as to what he did or didn't understood or was capable of understanding. And the court made those credibility determinations based upon what they heard from him and from his trial counsel. And generally, as an appellate court, we accept those credibility determinations, don't we?
Yes, I agree with that you accept credibility determinations. I mean, I would note that the order doesn't explicitly say I credit this testimony over that credit. So there isn't that. But that's where I think there's room for my argument, in the sense that what I was saying earlier is, I think there wasn't a nature to this that was a bit illusory. You know, he was told that he could potentially get out when he's 90. And I don't think that was ever really fleshed out about whether he understood if that was even possible, or, you know, the chances of that happening. And really, the plea bargain here, it's de facto a life sentence, unless he potentially lives, you know, beats the odds. And I don't think that circumstance wasn't talked about in the judge's order, or talked about on the record at all, about whether he understood that. And I think that's problematic here.
You only have a short moment. I'm sorry, Judge Smith, go ahead.
And that's apart from the problem of the mistake that's discovered afterwards, right?
It is. Because I think the mistake is analyzed under more of a manifest injustice standard, because we're bringing that now. It wasn't raised at the time.
If we can turn to that. So as I'm looking at your brief, you know, what you say is, had he known, you know, the correct criminal history score and what their ranges were for there and what middle of the box was for that, you know, he would have, it says, it is clear he would not have agreed to the duration in the state's counteroffer of 326 months on counts 2 and 3, which was above the middle of the box. Is that, are there factual questions that need to be determined on this direct? I know that we happen to have a fair and just evidentiary hearing before the question was determined. The issue was found, but so we have more record that we might have had, you know, without it on a direct appeal of this. But I'm just wondering if there were factual questions about what the state would have offered, what he would have accepted, et cetera, that aren't made.
Right. And I've thought about this, and I think that the record is clear that he agreed to middle of the box, that he thought he was getting middle of the box. And he turned out he didn't get that. And I think what the intent here is, what the parties talked about, was that he was trying to negotiate for every single month that he could at the end of his life. And so really this small amount of time between 0 point and 1 point really mattered. And I guess if I could just finish my thought really quickly, I just don't know if there'd be a meeting of the minds on this as well. The state might have came in at 326 and wanting more than middle of the box at 0 points. And Mr. Carter might have just said, no, that's too much time. Thanks. I'll use my time on rebuttal.
Thank you. And we'll turn now to respondent counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Jim Haas, and I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent, State of Minnesota. If I may just jump right into that point that was just being discussed about the second issue and Mr. Carter's understanding of the plea agreement, I think we have a fundamental disagreement as to the fact of what Mr. Carter did or didn't understand. For that argument to make sense, Mr. Carter would have to persuade us that he had a superior understanding of the sentencing guidelines and the grid than his own attorneys did at the time of the plea hearing. I mean, effectively, what he's saying is, gosh, I know my score should have been 0 for counts 2 and 3. I know that that would have rendered a lower number of, 306 months middle of the box. And that's what I thought the deal was. But that's not what the record shows. The numbers, whether it's middle of the box or whatever it is, were clearly articulated by not only Mr. Carter's attorneys, but the state, who followed up to make it clear. And both at the plea hearing and the sentencing hearing, those numbers and the total were clearly articulated, and Mr. Carter expressed no misunderstanding about that. So that's clearly a question of fact.
Right. Well, okay. So at the sentencing hearing, you know, there's a new defense counsel who wasn't part of the negotiation, right? And so it comes up quickly like, oh, judge, by the way, the criminal history is wrong, but we're still within the same range. But if we look at the plea hearing, I mean, unquestionably, there is a mutual misunderstanding about whether, I mean, the petition, I don't think, says middle of the box, but it seems like the testimony at the hearing talked about that they described as a middle of the box, 326 is the middle of the box on a criminal history score of 1. And he wasn't, and the criminal history score, and that is in fact 0. And the middle of the box is in fact 306. So why is that not a, why is that? I mean, it looks like a mutual mistake at the time of the plea, isn't it?
Even
if they came to the number?
I disagree with the term mutual misunderstanding as to the relevant parts of the plea. And I think by looking at the context of the plea negotiations, I think that makes that more clear. And I laid that out in my brief. Let me just turn to that on page 3. Mr. Carter was the one who initiated plea negotiations, and Mr. Carter first offered a 30-year deal, and the state rejected that. Mr. Carter then made a second offer for a 50-year sentence, and the state rejected that. And Mr. Carter offered a third for 76 and a half years, and that was rejected. All of the plea negotiations here involved years of time in prison. this notion of the middle of the box was simply a means to mathematically get there. Now, Mr. Carter's attorneys were mistaken in their read of the guidelines of what was or wasn't the middle of the box. But this plea agreement was not premised on middle of the box. It was premised on 90 years.
Is that a factual question that no district court decided? Like, I mean, because I think the counter argument is, well, it's not in fact 90 years. You could have done 90 years within a presumptive sentence, but you didn't. You did 89 in 10 months and you did it by the middle of the boxes and that was wrong. And that, and when you look at like the, I think the, they crossed out in months, you know, the plea petition, I don't think talks about years. It talks about months. So I'm just, with all of this, it seems like these are sort of factually directed questions, and that's not what we normally do. Like, what was the what was the core of this bargain, and would there have been a different bargain if someone had not misunderstood what was or was not the criminal history score?
Had this been raised below, the fact finder, the district court, could have taken testimony about that very question. The question being is, Mr. Carter, what was your subjective understanding of how long you would serve in prison as a part of this deal? And he could have testified to that, as could his attorneys. But that was not raised below. And so now we're seeing it here. And as I pointed out in my brief, I think the case law would say that the appropriate venue for those factual disputes would be the district court, in that he could bring a post-conviction pleading. Right. And I think he can do that. But
do you think that it has to be in other words, that our ruling wouldn't preclude it, that in fact this has to be by post-conviction? It can't be decided on direct appeal. Or do you think it could be decided on direct appeal? That's what I was unsure of.
I would say two things. One, I think the court could look at this record and say, there's just no conceivable way, no matter what he says on testimony, that he could have misunderstood the terms of this agreement. It was, by all accounts, a mutual agreement to essentially 90 years, give or take a month or two, in which case the court could rule. But if the court has any question or concern as to whether there's a fact question, then I think the remedy, as I've stated in my brief and the case law, is that the terms of an agreement and the defendant's understanding of that are a question of fact. And certainly Mr. Carter is not precluded from bringing a post-conviction petition. He has 2 years to do that, so it would not be untimely. But he is effectively inviting this court to become a fact finder as to his subjective understanding of the agreement, notwithstanding the fact that the actual numbers of months and years were stated clearly on the record, and he never objected to it and expressed no misunderstanding. So if that answers the court's question. Well, you know, the first issue, and probably I think the primary, is whether the district court abused its discretion in its decision. And I'd like to talk about the things that the court did to vindicate Mr. Carter's concerns here. First, the court ordered a Rule 201 examination at this juncture in the trial where none had been requested before. And even though the district court stated on the record and expressed that it did not observe any concerns about competency, ordered that. And Mr. Carter was found competent. The district court had a full evidentiary hearing where Mr. Carter and his attorneys all testified as to the sequence of events, including the plea negotiations leading up to the ultimate plea and the discussion that occurred during the plea colloquy when they took a recess and spoke with their client about his version of events, that he would effectively have to explain to the court. In other words, tell the court what you told us the first time was the essence of their conversation. And also that, by the way, you don't have to accept this agreement. You're free to have a trial. The grand jury is ready to go and we can take that path if you'd like. But if you want to plead guilty, you have to tell the judge effectively what you told us the first time. I think that's the essence of their testimony. And the district court, as the fact finder, apparently, or implicitly, if not explicitly, found their testimony more credible than Mr. Carter's. I'd also point out the court to the pre-sentence investigation and the sentencing worksheet. The court noted that, you know, this was not Mr. Carter's first time up at bat with respect to pleading guilty and the criminal justice system. He presented with six criminal history points on his first worksheet, but there's more in the pre-sentence investigation, including an extensive juvenile history. And I don't say that to impugn Mr. Carter, but when we're talking about his understanding of the process, his exposure and experience to being in court and pleading guilty, the district court also noted that in its order. And I think this court can take that into account as well in deciding if Judge Hain, as the fact finder here, was entitled to believe or disbelieve Mr. Carter's testimony. And I think the district court is very careful. We tend to see abuses of discretion when district courts are hasty or not making good record, not taking the time. But here, I think Judge Hain did everything she could to let Mr. Carter be heard, hear the testimony, consider the full record in its entire context, and make credibility determinations. It is a lower standard, fair and just standard. Nevertheless, the defendant still has to come forward with reasons, legitimate reasons that are believable to the district court. And he simply failed to meet even that low threshold here because the district court simply just did not believe that his attorneys were coercing him into pleading guilty. And the testimony was divergent. You know, Mr. Carter said A, his lawyer said B. She had to believe, it wasn't really even variations on a theme that was quite different. And so, as the court has alluded to, these factual findings are not clearly erroneous. And in context, the district court did not abuse its discretion by not allowing the plea withdrawal.
Anything else, Mr. Haas?
I don't think you've got five minutes
left. Don't want to cut you off.
No, I probably less is more. Unless the panel has any questions for me, I do think the second issue is kind of procedurally interesting about what is the proper forum and venue for these kinds of things. And I fleshed it out in my brief. I don't want to regale it to you, but I think we've kind of hit up on the conundrum here that if the question involves some fact, I think the forum to really flesh that out is in the district court. And I think Mr. Carter's subjective understanding is a question of fact.
And then I'm glad I wasn't going to have you stop. So it's not that you just kept talking that I'm back into this, but I appreciate it. Is what are the questions of fact? That's what I was thinking about. Is the question of fact what he subjectively understood? I understood what my lawyers described at the plea, which is I'm getting the middle of the box on what I assume is my correct criminal history score. And then the response, I think, like Mr. Mishick talked about, is like maybe the state would say, we'd never offer that. We were going for 90 years. We're not going to offer 40 months less than that or 42 months less than that, 86 years and 6 months. And so then there would never have been a meeting of the mind. Where does that take it then? And then there should be a plea withdrawal, right, if they wouldn't have agreed.
Well, again, there has to be a factual basis for it in the first place. And we're not there. I mean, I quote the prosecutor. He says 90 years repeatedly. In this, and just to clarify, this is on page 4 of my brief. The prosecutor says, and just to clarify and put the numbers together, the aggregate total will be 1,078 months. And the 2/3 calculation of that would serve 718 and 2/3, which equates to nearly 60 years. It is just shy of 60 years actual time with the 2/3 calculation. The sentence itself would be just shy of 90 years. The imposed sentence would be just shy of 90 years. And our argument is, throughout the context of these plea negotiations, it was 90 years. This court doesn't have the benefit of looking at the evidence, and we're not here to discuss sufficiency. But the state, as you can gather from the complaint, had a strong and compelling case. These acts were captured on video recordings, and Mr. Carter was not just a likely suspect. I mean, again, I don't want to go too far off that path, but you can gather here that the state was not interested in, and nor was the family. So finally, the state said, okay, fine, 90 years, we'll take 90 years, and you can avoid the grand jury and the prospect of life without the possibility of parole. And that's literally about how it transpires. We left it up to defense attorneys to fill out the Rule 15 petition. And I'm sure this court's well aware from practice is that, the prosecutor rarely sees the Rule 15 petition until the the plea hearing itself. It's often filled out in pen in the conference room outside the courtroom, and it gets handed to the judge. We often don't even see it. So, you know, there was a mistake in characterizing this number as representing the middle of the box, but our position, as a matter of fact, is that's not the nature of the discussions. That was not the nature of the meeting of the minds. The meeting of the minds was quite simple. 90 years or thereabouts. The state wasn't going to haggle about a month or two because it didn't quite, you know, make the 90. The prosecutor said it later at sentencing. It's 89 months or 89 years and 10 months is I think what it came out to. But again, stated that number crystal clear at the sentencing hearing. Mr. Carter was given a chance to speak. He did. And he expressed no concern. Hey, 89 years? I didn't sign up for 89 years and 10 months. That's not what I agreed to. That's what one would expect the record to show if he misunderstood how long he was going to serve in prison. And of course, that's the most important number.
So let me ask you this. If this is the remedy question, and Mr. Mishick can address it too if he wishes, but it seems to me the disagreement, if there was one, wasn't about the criminal history score. It was about the middle of the box. So assuming he was right about that, is the remedy withdrawal or is the remedy with resentencing with the middle of the box with a zero?
Well, I pointed that out in my brief as well, that the appellant is not asking to have his sentence recalculated. He only seeks to withdraw his plea. The appropriate remedy, I think, would be first, have him file a post-conviction pleading such that we could determine what the facts are. And if the court believes that the meeting of the minds was actually this lower number, this 300 and whatever it was, 306, well, then the district court, the sentencing judge, could readjust, recalculate the sentence in accordance with what it determines to be the meeting of the minds. But I don't think
326 would still be within the parameters.
And that's exactly what the prosecutor and Mr. Carter's attorney at sentencing stated.
You're out of time.
Thank you.
Let's go back to Mr. Mishick. You get the last word.
Thanks. I just, you know, respectfully to counsel for the state, I do think they're trying to make a factual issue here where there isn't one. You know, if you look at the record, attorney Traub, Lori Traub, she was the senior attorney here. Sam Schebel was the junior attorney. She said at the plea withdrawal hearing that this was a middle of the box sentence. She said that twice. She also said that at the plea hearing that it was a middle of the box sentence. And, you know, if you look at the plea petition itself, you know, these numbers that Mr. Carter initially offered were the low end of the box. He offered 363 on count one and then 278 on counts two and three. Those were low end of the box, assuming it's a one point, which he was wrong about. And then the state, as Lori Traub testified, they countered with the middle of the box sentence. So these numbers, you know, it'd be random just to choose these actual numbers. These are numbers represent the middle of the box. So I think there's enough in the record here, I think, to show that this was a middle of the box sentencing agreement, that Mr. Carter didn't receive.
And it shows that his lawyers understood it to be the middle of the box. But it also shows that he agreed to precisely what he got, which is 1,078 months. So I don't know what it shows us about what the prosecutors understood.
Well,
but
I think just backing up here and looking at the mutual mistake law, you know, the question is was there a mutual mistake? Yes, there was a mistake in the fact that if you look at the plea petition, they get the points wrong. You know, it says count two will be sentenced consecutively with one criminal history point, severity level 11. That is wrong. That's a wrong understanding of his situation. So he went into these plea negotiations and agreeing to something where he did not have a correct understanding about his legal circumstances. And if you look at the plea or the mutual mistake cases that I cited, you know, DeZeller and Benson, those are two cases where the defendant actually got a worse sentence. And Thomas and Howard's an unpublished cases. Those are cases where the defendant would have gotten a better sentence under the recalculation. The remedy in those cases isn't correction of the sentence. It's to allow the defendant to.
But those were all illegal sentences. This isn't an illegal sentence in the sense that it falls within the guidelines anyway.
I agree that it falls within the guidelines. I don't agree, though, that it's still not an illegal sentence, because if you look at the provost in Morstad, those two cases in a different context say that, you know, a sentence with an incorrect criminal history score is an illegal sentence. And that basically.
But he didn't receive a sentence with an illegal criminal history score. He was sentenced at zero. Right.
You're right. You're right. Yeah. So in the end, you're right. It was corrected back. So I agree with that. I agree with that statement. But I think my point is just the what I'm looking at here is the meeting of the minds and when the agreement was formed, what did they understand? And so, and he understood it as a one point on two and three, and it just wasn't right. So we don't.
Well, did he understand a one point necessarily, or did he understand a middle of the box? If I accept your argument, he was expecting a middle of the box sentence. So why isn't his remedy to go back and seek to be resentenced at the middle of the box or 306 on each count?
I think because the case law on mutual mistake, if you look at the cases I cited, they all state that the remedy here is to either give the defendant the choice to withdraw the plea or ask for resentencing. And he's asking for a plea withdrawal.
And understands the consequence. I mean, we've read the record. He's going to get indicted. He's going to get life without parole. I mean, is that, I don't know, maybe it's beyond where we're at right now, but it's hard for me to understand that that's what he would want to come out of this.
Well, yeah, I would just point you back to the plea record and how hard it was to get him to the point to admit to the facts. And I think that he believes the first version of the facts, and he was sticking to that version. And I guess on that factual question, he wants a trial.
So may I just ask Judge Working one follow-up question? And I'm sorry, I can't cite to the, and a lot of these cases are non-precedential, but the case, but it seems like when we've looked at cases, even if it has been a mutual mistake, if it's clear that the appellant would have agreed to apropos of the resentencing, it's clear that if he had agreed to 1,078, he'd probably agree to 1,038. And in fact, we know that he, according to, you know, what the argument you're making, that he would have agreed to a middle of the box on a zero criminal history score. So I am having trouble seeing why that's a manifest injustice that would require plea withdrawal as opposed to at most resentencing according to what he even is describing as his understanding of the.
Mr. Mishick, I'm just going to remind you, your time's expired, but please answer Judge Smith's question.
Thanks. I'll answer it. I think looking at the mutual mistake law, and there isn't much analysis on that question about what the defendant subjectively believes. So I don't know if I have a great answer, but I would say, again, you have to go back to what he understood, what the parties understood, and whether or not there was a mistake when the agreement was entered.
Any other questions, judges? It appears not. With that said, then,